Hello, I'm Dr. Lucy Blue, and this is the Dive and Dig In-Depth podcast. Today, we're talking to Professor John Adams from the University of Southampton. John was the Deputy Director of the Mary Rose Project and more recently led a groundbreaking project in the Black Sea. John discusses the impact of digital revolution on the field of maritime archaeology, how we have moved from spending weeks taking measurements and drawing shipwrecks to being able to record and produce a 3D printed model of a wreck in a matter of hours. He also describes the amazing feeling of discovering over 65 shipwrecks in the Black Sea, dating from the classical period right up to the 19th century, including a Roman wreck with the mast still intact. It's a real pleasure, John, to invite you to contribute to the podcast. Thank you very much for agreeing to do this.
No problem. I think it's a good thing to do.
I mean, obviously, we've known each other for many years, but I mean, you've been diving for how many years?
The 1960s. I learnt at school, so that's half a century ago.
Well, that's, I mean, he must have seen massive changes in terms of the technology and, you know, what we could actually achieve, not just for diving, but obviously with the application to maritime archaeology in that time.
Yes, enormous change. I suppose if you're talking about normal scuba for shallow water work, that hasn't changed a great deal. Because when we excavate on site, we still try and get rid of all the sort of stuff that is associated with recreational diving, because you don't want sort of dingly dangly bits and sort of gauges and stuff that aren't functional for the actual archaeology. So stripped down basic scuba for shallow water work it is pretty much the same. But where we are completely in a different field is with mixed gas technologies for working slightly deeper. So that sort of facility simply didn't exist when I started. Then, of course, the technologies for what you do when you get underwater, that has changed out of all recognition.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, so just to rewind a little bit, though, because, I mean, one of the biggest and most sort of iconic projects that you worked on, you know, in your initial career as a maritime archaeologist was the Mary Rose. It'd be really interesting to sort of discuss that a little bit, just in terms of the sort of methodologies that you were applying in terms of the documentation of the site.
I suppose at that stage, we were very much in an era of seeing how well we could transfer the techniques of excavation and survey on land to an underwater context. So there was very much a feeling in the Mary Rose team at the time, and very much driven by Margaret Rule, who was the director, that we should try and demonstrate that we could actually excavate with control and record with sufficient accuracy to justify having excavated in the first place, on the basis that, you know, if you excavate something as an archaeologist, you need to excavate and preserve it in some form or another, either in reality, physically, or by record. And so I went in the water in those days with my colleagues, people like Andy Fielding, my co-deputy director, with a conscious attempt to try and bring standards of what we were doing up to the levels at which land colleagues couldn't say, well, you know, that's a bit rough and ready, isn't it? Or, you know, you're only recording to the nearest 3 centimetres. That's no good. You know, so we went in with this sort of slightly competitive attitude on the basis that we needed to catch up with land archaeology. And, of course, this is the 1970s. This is half a century ago. And to a certain extent, that made it fun. That was a challenge. And Margaret was all for that. You know, she loved asking us to do pretty much what was impossible.
Well, Margaret Rule, she was the director of the project.
Yes, exactly. Margaret was amazing. I mean, she regularly asked us to do the impossible, but her trick was making us believe we could do it. And that's a lesson in leadership that I've never forgotten. So
yeah, that's true. But could you, I'm just quite curious, what you talk about this 3 centimetre difference. Why is that important to archaeologists?
Sometimes it's not. I mean, on land sites, you might be actually much more concerned as to tie a particular artefact or feature or piece of structure to a particular layer in terms of its stratigraphic sequence, rather than actually its XYZ coordinates, because knowing its XYZ coordinate to the nearest millimetre might not tell you any more than knowing where it is to the nearest metre. So accuracy for accuracy's sake is a waste of time and money. But sometimes, and this is a phrase I borrowed from Martin Carver, who excavated at Sutton Hoo, is that you've got to distinguish between what measurements that you take have analytical destiny and what don't. You can take thousands of measurements, which are completely useless, but some measurements are key, and some measurements of certain things in certain ways you need to be accurate. So if you're excavating scatters of ceramics, for instance, of a pot that has fallen down and broken and has been distributed by various mechanisms in the bottom of a part of a shipwreck, for example, knowing where all those sherds are to the nearest centimetre doesn't really tell you very much. It's much more important to actually recover them all and work out the context of that pot in relation to the rest of the assemblage. But if I'm then going to survey the ship's hull from an architectural point of view, with a view to reconstructing hull and the hull, and therefore taking that hull to the next stage of analysis in terms of analysing its performance, that is where I would want to get to a millimetric degree of accuracy. So it's accuracy is something that is contextual.
Yeah, and I guess ultimately what we're trying to do as archaeologists, maritime archaeologists, is build up a picture of, you know, what the ship would have been like, and ultimately how that wrecking process came about and what happened to the cargo and the crew within the context of that. So it's about putting those pieces of the puzzle together to build up a more complex picture.
Exactly. We have a fragmentary set of remains that relate to a once organised and functioning machine. And that's what we're trying to get back to understanding. And, of course, the people who are actually making it and doing it. And so in those early days on Mary Rose, we used to go in the water with fairly basic recording equipment, you know, rulers, plumb lines, tape measures and things like that. And we were recording in low visibility with seaweed floating past and catching on tape measures and stuff. We were trying to record a huge three-dimensional structure made of thousands of different components, none of which were actually regular. There was no flat surface, no right angle. Everything is, you know, covered with tool marks. It's created by hand and finished by eye. So it's not like recording an engineered piece of structure today. It's something. It's measuring the idiosyncrasies of something totally unique. And so, how to render that in three dimensions when you can only see a small part of it at any one time? That was an engaging challenge.
Challenge, especially with a low vis. I mean, that's one of the biggest challenges of working in the UK. Not being able to see beyond the end of your arm.
Yes. Well, you get very good at this sort of perception, which is building up a whole picture of something when you can only see a small part at once. And of course, most of the time the brain says, oh my God, I can't see it. You know, I can only see this small bit. I don't know what the rest of it is. But because your brain is recording, if you like, you gradually get more and more of a detailed perception of the whole thing, even though you never see it at one time. I mean, I was on a commercial diving job once in between Mary Rose seasons where we were working in pitch black water. And looking back now, I can see all the things that we were doing and working with. I can see their colour. I can feel them. I can, you know, but I never actually saw them. It's a very weird thing that the brain does, seeing with these.
Yes, indeed. And you mentioned the aspects of technology. You talked about rebreathers, mm-hmm. And it would be interesting to. I mean, basically, rebreathers get us deeper, keep us down, well, to depths that we couldn't go to, and obviously for longer because.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, those changes in technology in terms of diving. What do you see as one of the key things? Rebreathers. I mean, where do you?
I think the rebreathers are significant because they've extended our capability in many ways. I mean, mixed gas diving, in other words, the ability to use different gases to actually go deeper and stay longer, have been around in the commercial world for decades. And depths of, you know, 250 metres or so are relatively straightforward in the commercial world, but not in scientific diving. If you're talking about conventional scuba where you're breathing compressed air, It's really 30 or 40 metres that's the practical limit, 50 in a lot of regimes in terms of safety. But as I know from my own experience, working on compressed air below about 25 metres, you know, the brain becomes increasingly affected by nitrogen narcosis. And although if you're just swimming around looking at stuff, you're not aware of it, it's quite interesting when you give a task that is technically different or difficult or requires a little bit of brain, a little bit of thought to somebody to go in 30 metres diving on air, and they'll come back having made all sorts of mistakes that they sometimes can't believe they've made themselves. And that's the effect of the gases. So the different gases give us the opportunity to work with a clear brain differently. It's not so much, for instance, you can go into on nitrox and sort of enriched air, so we change the ratio between oxygen and nitrogen. That makes an enormous difference at about 30 metres, down to about 40 metres or so. Then you can go on to trimix, which is helium, nitrogen and oxygen. And the chief advantage is not so much that they give you more time. Your dives might be longer, but that 3/4 of that is decompression. So the actual bottom time isn't that much different. But the real difference is you're working with a clear head. Your head is as clear, your brain is working as clearly and as fast as it would in 3 metres of water in a swimming pool. And that's in terms of what we do, in terms of looking and seeing and thinking, interpreting, recording, all that stuff, that's the most important thing.
That's really interesting, because I've not worked with rebreathers or anything like that. You just think of it as deeper, not necessarily clarity of mind. And that is, I guess, that's quite... insightful.
I think that came home to me. In fact, when I was working commercially, I was out working for Comex out in the Gulf, and we were working down to 50 metres on air. Well, in practice, 40, 45 metres. And one day they got us to do a job on a wellhead, which was at 55 metres. And they weren't sure whether that we were going to be able to do it on heliox or not. And we went in the water thinking we were going to be in a wet belt diving on air, but we weren't. And being at 55 metres in those conditions, it was like being in 3 metres of water in a warm, clear water swimming pool. And it was just the contrast between what I felt like breathing air at 45 metres and breathing heliox at 55 was just completely different. So that from that on, you know, I was working commercially at the time, but I was thinking as an archaeologist. I said, this is the secret. This, my brain works, my gosh, you know, and I can now survey. And I could think,
yeah,
I could do something.
Real point of
fantastic.
Epiphany. That's really, yeah.
Yes, it was. Yeah, it was. Absolutely
fantastic.
Was, yeah.
But also, I mean, you're internationally renowned as being a world-leading maritime archaeologist, but a lot of the things that you've been doing more recently is not just diving deeper, but also exploring the depths in terms of other technologies.
Yes, yeah.
I mean, obviously, we've seen a massive change in technology over the last decades, both in terms of the tools that we use to find sites, to detect sites, but also to document sites. I mean, maybe you could just explore a little bit about those different techniques, that how they've impacted on improving our job, getting deeper.
I think, yes. I think one of the... I suppose, in general, the digital revolution has made an enormous difference to what we do. Some of our original systems, like geophysics systems, you know, detecting, modelling the seabed, recording the nature of the seabed, and seeing below the seabed with acoustics. Until the 1990s, these systems were analogue, and they weren't particularly easy to use, and, something that would make a geophysicist excited, you know, an archaeologist would look at it and go, that's a splodge, what does that mean? But then the digital technologies, the digital versions of these things came on, and then the resolution crept up, the graphic representation of what was really being recorded and revealed increased. The cost of the systems came down, the ease of use increased, and things that were once exotic and out of reach for most people are now within reach of most people. And so SeiSCAN sonars, swarthmometry, multi-beam systems, and even small remotely operated vehicles, you know, none of these were available outside of rich industrial companies or navies and things sort of 30 or 40 years ago. Now they're much more accessible. And the capabilities have just increased so much that we are able to work faster, more efficiently, more accurately, and recover more data. So, and add to that the advances in photographic, imaging, again, because of the digital revolution. On the Mary Rose, we were experimenting with various photographic techniques, photomosaics and photogrammetry. But we were limited by the computer code available, the software, and of course the hardware at the time. Now we have all these things that are blissfully easy to use. It's so high resolution, three-dimensional recording of complex structures underwater. Something that would have taken months, if not years, with tape measures and cameras and stuff like that, even up to about 10 years ago. Now, done in a matter of hours.
Yeah, no, it is quite amazing. I mean, even that sort of area coverage, I guess. I mean, lasers have obviously made a big difference to that as well, on land and increasingly so underwater.
Indeed. Yeah.
But it's really about trying to encapsulate those images so that we can, mapping things in a comprehensive manner. So what about, perhaps your most famous project recently is the work you've been doing in the Black Sea. What sort of technologies have you been applying in that context?
So the Black Sea project, funded by the Julian Hans Rausing Trust, was primarily directed at prehistory and the environmental changes that we know occurred in the Black Sea region, and which had a dramatic effect on later prehistoric populations. But there has been 50 years of oceanographic research resulting in masses of data, but all taken by different systems, by different people, for different purposes and at different resolutions. And of course, this has spawned all sorts of disparate and competing theories about what happened, when and how it happened. And so that was the fundamental reason we went out there, working on submerged landscapes. But in the process, we knew we were going to find shipwrecks. And the terms of our permit meant that if we found a shipwreck, we needed to assess it and we needed to include that in our reporting to the Bulgarian authorities. And it was a fantastic combination, because we actually achieved our aims in terms of prehistoric research and in terms of geological analysis of process that happened over the last 30,000 years or so. But we also found 65 historic wrecks covering a period from the classical Greek world all the way up to the 19th century. And the reason that was possible in a relatively short time is three seasons of ship time, about between 25 and 30 days, which is not really a lot of time. And to do all that, it was robotics and it was digital software and it was photogrammetry.
And so what sort of depths are you talking about in terms of identifying these ships?
Well, we had our geological focus was on the Bulgarian shelf. Okay, so that's the continental shelf that extends to about 40, 50, 60 kilometres out from the Bulgarian coast. Then it drops off to the abyssal plain of the Black Sea down to 2,200 metres. We find wrecks all the way out, of course. So although it's the 100-metre deep continental shelf that would have been populated with people in prehistoric times because the water was so much lower, since then, the water came back, of course, after the Ice Age, and people have been sailing up and down that coast with great intensity for thousands of years. And so you find shipwrecks on the shelf, but you also find them all the way down the slope to the abyssal plain. And that's because the Black Sea has been used, sailed so intensively by all the cultures that surrounded it for thousands of years. Seafaring, be what it is a hazardous pursuit. Every now and again, a ship doesn't make it, and they're all down there.
I'm sorry, but you're saying you're finding... How are you finding these ships?
It's geophysics. Geophysics, there's a suite of systems essentially using sound. So we know sound propagates through water, we know how fast it goes, so we can actually time a signal, and we can convert, if we measure the time a signal takes, we can convert that to a distance. And that's the basis of all the sonar systems, which transmit sound and receive the echo from the seafloor or even below the seafloor, and you process that echo, and then you can actually essentially interpret what the sound has bounced off, whether it's on the seabed, above it, or actually indeed below the seafloor. So we have systems that are designed to produce an acoustic map of the seafloor. So that tells us sandy bottom, gravelly bottom, mud or whatever. And it will also show us things on or poking through the seabed, like shipwrecks. So perhaps that system is the one, and also because you can cover a wide swath of seabed as you go over it with the ship, you are essentially mapping the seafloor these days pretty much in real time as you go over the seafloor. And you get all these indications, many of which you will have no clue what they are when you find them. But then you go back with a different system and you look at them in more detail. So in order to work out what the indications are, you then go back over with a vessel and you put an ROV down, a remotely operated vehicle. And that is essentially something the size of a small truck, a large SUV, say, festooned with cameras and lights and various other sampling equipment. In fact, you can put on an ROV whatever you need for the scientific job in hand. For us, that was mostly cameras, although we did have a small water suction dredge and some sample trays and stuff like that. So we were taking samples.
Yeah, so to facilitate some excavation and sampling. And
exactly. But primarily, what we were about was recording. So high-resolution video, in fact, ultra-high-resolution video, 4K and 6K, and then high-resolution still photographs. And the still photographs, partly from the high-resolution video, but mostly from the still photograph, the still cameras, we were taking pictures of whatever we found. And the photogrammetric techniques essentially digitally stitches all those individual photographs together and produces a three-dimensional digital model of whatever you're recording. And we were surveying wrecks within about an hour and a half with comprehensive coverage in more than 2 kilometres of water.
That's just amazing, isn't it, really?
It was. Okay. And of course, the marvellous thing was that actually it was the earliest and most interesting ships that were the best preserved. Mm. So, and they were in the deepest water furthest from the coast. So, none of this ancient seafarers being too scared to leave the shore. You know, these people were out on the open sea going backwards and forwards. And the reason the ships are down there, probably because they foundered in bad weather. But we have Roman ships sitting down there with their masts still standing. We have a Greek ship lying almost intact on the seabed with the rowing benches that's still visible and stuff like that. The rudders and the tillers still attached. It's like, you know, you read storybooks as a child and you have an illustration of a shipwreck, and then you grow up and you think, well, you know, obviously real shipwrecks aren't really like that. And then you see them on the bottom of the Black Sea, and actually they're even better.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, the archaeological discoveries are quite out of this world, but I mean, I think it's also the fact that you can document a vessel of such complex preservation on the scale and depth that you're working in an hour or so. I mean, and produce a three-dimensional image of that. I mean, if we think about that retrospectively in terms of the things you were doing on the Mary Rose, or even Honor was doing on the Marsala ship, or it's quite incredible, as you say, how much more we can.
Yes, we've gone from working out all our measurements on big drawing tables and sort of plotting them out and spending weeks, if not months, producing the drawings of the surveys that we've made during the excavation season. We've gone from that to, one of the guys coming in and says, yes, okay, everything's aligned after an hour or so on the wreck, sail away to the next wreck. Meanwhile, they're processing the model. And then the next day, rather than drawing the survey, we're holding up a 3D printed model of the ship, going, ah, yes, I didn't notice that bit when we were underwater. the last sort of 10 years or so with photogrammetry and 3D printing, for instance, that the way we were working those things, those technologies, into the way we were looking at wrecks, completely different to what we were doing even 10 years ago.
Amazing. So what do you think, if you'd have to say, what is the absolute bit of technology that really has moved things forward? I don't know if it's possible.
Ooh.
It's a sweet in a way, isn't it? So,
yeah. I mean, I think digital geophysical systems are such powerful tools. I can't really conceive of running any maritime archaeological research program without them now. I mean, you can, if you're working on a, if you're looking at the scale of the site, you can still do good archaeology with bits of string and a tape measure. But if you want to do much more and to different resolutions and faster and stuff, it's the digital systems have really transformed. And of course, now we've got lots more people available to do it. What I didn't explain was that in the Black Sea, you have this stratified water column. And below about 150 metres, there is no oxygen in the water. And so organic material will decay very, very slowly. And so if a wooden ship with its cargoes and rigging and everything sinks to a depth below 100 metres, if nothing else disturbs it, it will stay there for centuries, if not thousands of years. And that's what we found in the bottom of the Black Sea. And we found Ottoman, Byzantine, Roman and Greek ships 2 kilometres down, right on the bottom of the abyssal plain in the Black Sea. We have a Roman wreck, probably from the 1st century AD, sitting upright on the bottom of the sea with its mast still standing, ropes still draped around the frames, both quarter rudders still attached, the tillers attached to the rudders. The only damage to the stem and the stern was probably done during the wrecking process. And so since then, 2,000 years have passed it by. And it's absolutely extraordinary. When we first came upon that wreck with the ROV, as we came towards the hull, for the first couple of minutes, I thought I was looking at a modern trawler or something. But then as the ROV panned along the side of the ship and the quarter rudders came into view, which are diagnostic for ancient forms of ship construction, we realised we were dealing with something quite extraordinary.
That's quite... I can't imagine that feeling. It must have been so exciting.
You're not quite sure it's really happening. It's just unbelievable. Yeah. And we had another another moment like that with a Greek ship. We didn't realise quite how old and that it was Greek until having done the survey, and we thought, this is an old ship. This has got quarter rudders exposed, etc. But then we excavated down the side of one of the rudders. We exposed the rudder blade. And then we got to the foot, the spade end of the rudder blade, and it was it's a very characteristic shape. And that shape of rudder you can see on red figureware vases in the British Museum from the 5th century BC of these Greek ships that are both sail-powered and oar-powered. And that was another moment of revelation. This is a ship from about 400 BC, and it's virtually intact, lying on the bottom of the Black Sea. It's just incredible.
No, it's that Tintin moment.
Well, absolutely. I mean, that's a good point, because, you know, when you're young, you read Tintin books and you see pictures of shipwrecks and stuff like that. And then you grow up and you think, well, yeah, obviously shipwrecks aren't really like that at all. And then you go to the Baltic and then the Black Sea and you find, actually, they can be better.
No, absolutely. The preservation is quite remarkable.
Yeah, it is.
What an exciting research career you're having had.
Well, having hopefully. And that's the thing. I mean, for anybody coming into this field of archaeology, don't think for a minute that, you know, it's all been done. All the best discoveries have been made, because they're still happening. You know, it is amazing. It's an incredible field to be involved in.
Truly inspirational. It's always wonderful speaking with John, tapping into his wealth of knowledge and hearing about those moments of discovery. I hope you enjoyed this Dive and Dig in-depth podcast, supported by the Honor Frost Foundation, a charity that promotes maritime archaeology in the Eastern Mediterranean. In the next episode, we'll probe even deeper into the shipwrecks to explore their cargo and how we can use the latest scientific techniques to reveal more about what these ships were carrying and where they came from. Join me, Lucy Blue, as I talk to Dr. Stella Domestica and Cynthia Ann Spiteri to explore ancient shipwrecks off the coast of Cyprus and a Phoenician wreck off Malta.